It's Central Time. I'm Rob Fair.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we give you a history of the state's voter ID law and tell you what you need to vote in this year's presidential election.
First, after more than a year-long downturn for the frac sand industry in Wisconsin, two previously closed operations in the Chippewa Valley have resumed operations.
Earlier this year, a number of mines across the state suspended operations in response to falling demand for frac sand. The closures resulted in a string of layoffs. Now, with the two facilities reopening, some are wondering if the frac sand industry is rebounding and if other mines will follow suit.
Rich Kramer joins us now. He's WPR's reporter in Eau Claire. He covers the state's frac sand industry. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be on the show again.
Well, before we get into the big picture of the industry, tell us about what's happening in the Eau Claire and Menominee areas with these two frac sand mines resuming at least some of their operations.
Yeah, two plants, one in Augusta, which is south of Eau Claire, that's owned by High Crush Proppants, a Texas-based company. That has opened up, I'm told. I couldn't get any confirmation from the company itself, but I spoke with the state's Wisconsin Industrial Sand Association, and they were the ones that told me that that plant has reopened. In Menominee, which is to the west of Eau Claire, there is Fairmont Santrol, which is, this sand plant has been in operation for a while in Menominee, but they shut down again, along with High Crush and many other companies in the downturn that started in late 2015 and this year. So we've got two plants opening up. The Fairmont Santrol plant is only going to what's called a one shift, so they're only bringing seven employees back, and they're, I'm told, not even focusing strictly on sand that's used in oil and natural gas drilling. They're going to be focusing on recreational products, industrial products. These companies also supply sand for things like foundries, which use the sand to make molds for casting metals, also for golf courses, beach sand, you name it.
Right. The thing that led to this big boom in sand mining in Wisconsin was fracking. The sand is used as part of what it takes to get the oil or natural gas out of the ground, in effect, right?
Right. The sand is basically, think of it, a grain of sand as a little tiny car jack. So they blast a lot of water and chemicals into the ground after they drill a hole. It cracks apart, makes little fissures in the rock and shale, especially. And then the sand grains wedge their way into the shale and prop it open so that you can get the hydrocarbons out.
When we first started talking to you, Rich, on this show about frac sand, it was in the midst of a boom. How big did this get in Wisconsin at its peak?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, anyone that lives in western Wisconsin saw a lot of these companies opening up. Counties were really inundated. So the demand for frac sand skyrocketed between 2011 and 2014. This is when U.S. oil drillers were going wild in places like North Dakota, Texas, over in Pennsylvania. They were drilling. Oil prices were high. They were over $100 a barrel at times, but on average, right around $100 a barrel. So that meant they needed all the sand they could get, and we really were kind of racing to catch up to the demand. And then once that hit equilibrium, then oil prices crashed.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about frac sand mining in Wisconsin with a couple of previously closed operations getting back into business. And Rich, yeah, where are we before these two new plants? Where are we now? As you say, the prices came down, the market stabilized. People weren't as interested in this Wisconsin sand anymore.
Right. Well, there's still drilling going on in the U.S., but far fewer exploratory wells are being drilled. So the demand for sand just kind of fell off the charts at the beginning of this year and towards the end of 2015. A lot of companies shut down their plants or idled them. They're just going to wait until better times come along. So Fairmont Santrol, they announced that they had laid off 55 employees. U.S. Silica laid off 30 employees at a plant near Sparta. There's a company, Unimin, that laid off 65 employees at Tunnel City. They announced that they were hiring those folks back, though. It was kind of an interesting turn there. But also Superior Silica laid off 69 employees. So we're still, by no means are we recovering, but what I'm hearing from some of these folks at these companies is that they're seeing optimistic trends. So There's more sand being used in each of these wells. They found out, drillers have found out that if they put millions and millions of tons of sand into one well, they can get more oil. So they're becoming more efficient. There's still demand, but there's not the kind of demand we saw in 2014. And that, there's still questions of what is normal for this industry, because 2014 was by no means normal.
And Rich, as you've reported, this whole industry is seen as a double-edged sword. Some people are excited about the economic opportunity, the jobs. Other people are worried about the environmental and health impacts. Can you talk about some of the concerns and protests against frac sand mining?
Absolutely. There was a lot of protests. I mean, part of the protest and the anger and confusion and concerns about industrial sand mining or frac sand mining was that you had an industry that went from maybe 10 facilities in 2008 to more than 100 in 2014. I mean, it just grew so fast, and a lot of local governments weren't prepared for it. Concerns that people had, number one, if you're living in the country, you've had a pretty peaceful existence out there, well then, an industrial facility that operates 24 hours a day moves next door, so that caused some anger. There's also people that are still very worried about health concerns from dust blowing from these sand mines. And now the DNR is looking into groundwater. There's parts of the sandstone that these companies are interested down in Trempealeau County and even La Crosse County, where there's questions about heavy metals in the sand. So they're wondering if the mining will expose that to air and then cause basically acid mine drainage.
As we wrap up, Rich, those arguments are not done yet for sure. You said there was optimism in the industry that it might be bouncing back some. We look at these two mines that you just reported on coming back into business. Are people saying, yeah, this is the beginning of something big again, or is this just a momentary fluctuation?
It's hard to say, but analysts have been telling me that they expect the market to start coming back in 2016 and to see a lot better recovery, a lot better prices and demand in 2017. Right now, oil is still right around $40 a barrel. I've been told that once oil hits $60 a barrel, these oil and gas drillers will start doing their thing again to a much greater extent. Therefore, they'll need more sand.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR's reporter in Eau Claire, where he covers the state's frac sand industry. Early voting has already begun in parts of Wisconsin and starts today in Madison and Milwaukee. This year will be the first time that Wisconsin's voter ID law will be in effect during a general election. The debate around voter ID has taken a lot of twists and turns in Wisconsin since it was first introduced 5 years ago. So WPR reporters Sean Johnson and Laurel White, who've been covering the changes in the state's voter ID law, teamed up with WisContext's Scott Gordon and created an interactive timeline of the law's evolution.
If you go to WPR.org/voter ID, you can see it for yourself, and you can also find out exactly what you need to vote this year. WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and WPR State Capital reporter Laurel White join us now to tell us more about that project. Sean and Laurel, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
And Sean, take us back to the beginning, and you have looked all the way back to the beginning, the history of the voter ID law and the challenges in court in Wisconsin. And right now I want to go back to 2011 when this all began. What started it?
Well, what started it is the Republicans took over state government, and voter ID is something that they talked about passing for, you know, really a decade. It had been vetoed by Democratic Governor Jim Doyle. They had all the wheels of state government, and they used it relatively quickly. By that summer, they had passed a voter ID law that, you know, in hindsight, was one of the most restrictive in the nation.
And what were some of the components of the law?
The major component is that you would now have to show a state-issued ID to vote, which is completely different than we'd done in Wisconsin's, you know, lengthy history in the past. I mean, there'd been this general progression of voting laws in Wisconsin that made it easier to vote, and this went the other way. I think the thing that you realize as you look at all these court cases and where they've succeeded is that the law didn't have a lot of avenues for people who not only didn't have an ID, but in some cases, indigent people who didn't have the documents they needed to get that ID. And that's where a lot of these court cases that are ongoing today are centered on is that small group of people, but that group of people that the courts have found does not have an avenue to vote under Wisconsin's law.
And you mentioned more than one case, and I think if I've got the math right here, there have been four of them, two of them ongoing. Can you give us a brief snapshot of some of the cases? And some of them have been resolved, some not.
Yeah, this has been a truly long and convoluted legal battle. And it was actually, I mean, Laurel was talking one day and had the idea that we need to have a timeline to figure this out. I mean, as you look back at this voter ID case, even people who are in the business of law and elections, they say they've never really seen anything like this. It started in 2011 when Republicans passed the law. Shortly thereafter, you had a couple cases that were complaints that were filed in state court. Those were filed in 2011. By 2012, early 2012, Dane County Circuit Court judges, two of them, block the law, and it basically stays blocked for a couple years in state court. In 2014, a federal district court judge steps in, and he blocks the law, and so you've got it now blocked in state court and federal court. The state Supreme Court comes in and says voter ID is okay, but it doesn't matter because it's still in that federal case. Eventually, you get the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago stepping in and saying, let's implement voter ID. You know, really, just a few days later, the U.S. Supreme Court says, no, not right now, not this close to an election. And so the reason we're talking about this now is that we didn't have voter ID in 2012. We didn't have voter ID in 2014. This is going to be the first major election in November of 2016 when we've had voter ID in Wisconsin. And so looking at that timeline gives you a better idea of how we got to where we are.
And it is. I mean, it's prodigious. I can tell the amount of work that went into this timeline that the two of you have put together. It's complicated. And so looking back at 2011 when this all began, does that initial law match what will be on the books in 2016?
No, it doesn't. I mean, big picture, it does in that if you want to go vote in Wisconsin, you're going to have a photo ID. And so, you know, in big picture, that is going to be the case. Where it differs is on the margins, and when it comes to voters who are, you know, for whatever reason, don't have the documents they need to get an ID to vote. I mean, there's some fairly complicated cases in the most recent court case, the one Wisconsin Institute case, which Laurel covered, some fairly concrete examples of people who say, there are many hurdles that are keeping me from voting, and you know, those were persuasive not only to the district court judge, but also to the Court of Appeals in Chicago, which had stepped in and I guess been on the state of Wisconsin side in these cases before. But it's letting this most recent court case go forward, which is allowing for earlier voting in Wisconsin and which struck down some Republican-backed laws.
We're talking to Sean Johnson and Laurel White right now. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and Laurel White is our state Capitol reporter. And we're talking about a new resource they put together, taking a comprehensive look at the history of Wisconsin's voter ID law. And we should say it's a work in progress because there are still some dangling federal cases out there to look at. So voter ID fraud has been at the center of the conversation about this law, the debate, and initially there were, it breaks down as a partisan issue. Republicans have said that there are widespread instances of voter fraud, and Democrats have said this is a voter suppression law. Is that still the debate today?
That debate, I don't know when that debate's going to stop. I can say that federal courts are starting to look at the issue differently, and just because there's a lot more empirical evidence out there when it comes to voting laws and really a lack of instances of voter fraud of the type that voter ID would prevent. And so you're seeing federal courts dismiss the idea more and more that voter fraud or that this idea that there's widespread voter fraud out there is definitely less persuasive in the federal court system than it used to be. I think you even look at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Posner wrote the decision years ago for the state of Indiana that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court and is the reason that voter ID laws have been upheld in the United States. He has since had a big change of heart on voter ID laws, and Judge Posner now says that a lot of the reasoning that was put behind them in the beginning doesn't hold up, that we have this history behind us now, and he can see, at least, in his mind, the reasons that he gave for upholding voter ID when he did, he's no longer on board with them. And you are seeing some other courts of appeals in the United States strike down voter ID laws. It happened recently in North Carolina. And so I think that raises the possibility that you could see another challenge in Wisconsin that would try to go at the law as a whole again.
And I'm curious from both of you. I mean, this is right now it looks to be in effect, but I'm looking at your timeline and there are a couple cases there that are still dangling. Does this mean that there could be an 11th hour turnaround here on this and there could be a halt to the law before the election?
Well, certainly not before this November election. As the cases, the two federal cases, are ongoing, judges have made a point in their decisions to say some changes that I'm requiring aren't going to be required until after the election, because they don't want to disrupt the election. There's been a lot of discussion about the confusing changes for Wisconsin voters, and the courts do seem to be attempting to mitigate that confusion.
And how is that being mitigated so far?
Well, you know, the state legislature actually has had enough concern about potential voter confusion that they authorized a $250,000 voter education campaign that the State Elections Commission is carrying out. They're doing, you know, radio ads, digital ads on things like Facebook to let voters know that they do need to bring a photo ID to the polls in November. Because those who have been keyed in have been hearing, as Sean was talking about, since 2011, voter IDs on, voter IDs off. And some folks are confused about, you know, what qualifies as a voter ID, whether they need to bring it or not, and how to get one if they don't have something like a driver's license. So there's been a lot of discussion about that confusion and how to prevent it.
And we had mentioned, again, looking at your timeline, some of the provisions for people who might have trouble getting a license, getting a voter ID, I should say, for the election. And Judge James Peterson was part of this decision, and this affects where we'll be on November 8th. So, Laurel, do you want to tell us a little bit, or Sean, either one of you who's up to speed on that, where that stands and what changes he had made?
Sure. So in Judge Peterson's decision, he actually called for the reform of this process called the IDPP, which is for people who don't have a driver's license that are trying to get a free state-issued ID for voting, but they can't locate the documents that they need to get that free state ID. So they can't find their birth certificate, they don't have a marriage certificate, anything like that. So Judge Peterson, in his decision, actually said this petition process is, I think his exact word was, disaster. So he said this petition process needs to be reformed, but we're going to wait until after November's election to do that. The petition process can stay in place as it is right now, but people who are going through the petition process should be issued a receipt, and that receipt will have their picture on it, and they can use that for voting on November 8th. So a lot of the cases right now, or the two federal cases, are focused on ways that people can vote if they don't have a traditional ID like a driver's license. So there's been a lot of discussion about that petition process. There was a possibility of an affidavit used for voting that was floated for a little bit, but that's not in place now. But what will be in place for November are those receipts.
Early voting has already started in several communities around Wisconsin, and it starts in person today in Madison and Milwaukee. This is an interesting one because at one point there were some restrictions placed upon early voting. So, Laurel, can you give us a little bit of the history there?
Right. So that was another element of Judge Peterson's decision, actually. So he struck down a lot of restrictions on early voting that had been passed in Wisconsin since 2011. He said that restrictions on early voting actually amounted to intentional racial discrimination. And he mentioned the city of Milwaukee in particular when he wrote that, saying that people who tend to utilize early voting are, you know, minority communities, the elderly, students, and that limiting those hours was discriminatory to them. So he struck down limitations on evening voting, on weekend voting, and as a result of that being struck down, we have more early voting in Wisconsin, I think, than we have ever had before.
And obviously a very complicated saga. You put it all together so that it's easy to understand. Can you tell us, if people want to go check it out, get the history of it, where can they go?
Well, they can go to WPR.org/voter ID, and we've got a Q&A on early voting. We've got a timeline that goes all the way from 2011 to today that you can track and see all of the cases and decisions. You can look at the actual court documents. And we also have a narrative history of everything if you'd prefer to read through it rather than clicking through an interactive.
And Laurel, real basic question, what does someone need to vote?
Well, if you have a state-issued driver's license, a Wisconsin driver's license, it can't be an out-of-state license, that's all you need to vote. There's a long list of other things that you can use if you don't have a driver's license. If you go to myvote.wi.gov, there's a list there. You can use, just to give you a few of those, a free state-issued ID card. You can use your passport, a military ID, an identification card issued by a federally recognized Indian tribe. So there's actually a fairly extensive list. But if you have a driver's license, that's your go-to. You can definitely use that.
Thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That was WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and WPR State Capitol Reporter Laurel White. You can find more info at WPR.org/voter ID.
From regular hand washing to sterilized bottles, antibiotics to antibacterial soaps, we have done a lot to keep our kids as germ-free as possible.
Our next guest says there have been a lot of benefits from modern hygiene, but we often take things too far. Instead of treating microbes as the enemy, more and more scientific evidence points toward the benefits of the bacteria that live among us and inside of us. And if we try too hard to wipe out the bad stuff, we can lose the benefits of the good stuff.
Marie Claire Arrieta joins us now. She's a microbiologist and assistant professor at the University of Calgary, and she's the co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Marie Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it seems like there's this big attitude change toward microbes, where a lot of us, at least in the popular culture, thought of them as the enemy, something to be eradicated as much as possible, to seeing them as providing a lot of benefits, being important to who we are and how we come into being.
That's right. So microbes cannot be put under the same umbrella. Rightly so, some of them are, you know, to be feared because they cause very dangerous in infections. But we live in most industrialized countries and societies that expose us to a very reduced risk for these infections, thanks to hygiene measures, thanks to vaccines, and thanks to antibiotics. And all of these are wonderful ways of reducing the risk of disease. But I think we've gone too far, as you were saying before in the introduction. Microbes also are part of who we are. And this is a new side of microbes that we didn't know about until up to about 10 years ago. They really are part of our bodies. We rely on microbes, especially as children, to perform essential tasks for our development, like the maturation of our immune system, regulating how we spend energy, how we store fats, like really important stuff that we cannot do without microbes.
A lot of what you're writing seems to be a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is sanitation, hygiene, antibiotics have helped stop a lot of really horrible diseases in the industrial countries anyway. But along with that, because of some of what we've done to the good microbes, you write that we're seeing rises in asthma, in autoimmune disorders. Can you talk about some of the consequences there?
Yeah. So basically, since we realized that microbes perform such important tasks for our immune system and our metabolism early on, What happens is if we miss out or we deplete this exposure of microbes early on, we do not get the proper training necessary for our immune system or our metabolism. So there's study after study showing that if you receive antibiotics during the first year of life or even during the late phases of pregnancy, that very strongly associates with a baby later on going to develop asthma, allergies, obesity, diabetes, autoimmune disease, many different diseases, all associated to these changes in what we call the microbiome or this community of microbes in early life, along with antibiotic use is, for example, a C-section. We never thought of a C-section being as detrimental for health, but it happens that when we're born via C-section, we miss out on that first bath of microbes that normally we would obtain through vaginal and fecal secretions during a vaginal birth. So just by being born via C-section, that increases the chances between 15 to 30% of developing asthma and allergies.
One thing that makes it hard to talk about this, I think, is you're making the case that we've gone too far, but you're also trying to say we can't overcorrect and go in the other direction. We don't want to completely throw away the antibiotics or the hand washing or C-sections, for that matter, are sometimes medically necessary.
They are. And, we can't be... We have to be realistic, right? We live in a modern society. And vaccines, this is such an important point to make because vaccines is one of the only public health measures that we have to prevent some of the worst infections. And without vaccines, they will come back, as it has happened in countries where vaccinations rates have gone down. So we depend on these types of measures to try and prevent some of the most dangerous diseases. With antibiotics, they're a little bit of a double-edged sword because we need them. If we have a bad bacterial infection, there's no way around it. We have to take them. But we really need to restrict their use. Antibiotics are nowadays overused and abused, and one should never push a family doctor to give a child an antibiotic because they do come with side effects. But at the end of the day, what we try to do with the book is to provide information to reach this balance as much as we can between disease prevention and also what we consider a healthy exposure to microbes.
We're talking to Marie-Claire Arrieta. She's co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World, talking about kids and germs. And germs are not a dirty word anymore for kids. Marie-Claire, as you were just saying, a lot of your book is aimed at practical advice for parents in particular. I want to get into some of that. Let's talk about how much we should let kids get dirty and go out in the world and put things in their mouths. So one time at a restaurant bar in town, one of my kids, who was then two, we saw she was eating a pickle. She didn't have a pickle. We asked where she got it. It was from the floor. As a parent, I feel some revulsion there. But maybe that wasn't a good example. But maybe we need to not freak out so much when kids are out there exploring the world.
Yeah, it's hard not to freak out. I have two young children, and you get freaked out. The important thing is to understand that not all dirt is equal. So, yes. If you're out in a public space where there's lots of people and you see your child picking something from the ground and putting it in the mouth, it's not a really good idea. There's lots of people there, and whenever there's a high concentration of people, the risk of diseases goes up. But if your child is out in the park or out in the countryside or in your own home, the risk of disease, of contracting a disease, really goes down. So you really can let that go, and it's fine to have your child put something in his or her mouth or to play with dirt. But there's some areas where you have to be a bit careful, a subway station, a crowded mall, those types of things. I think it's important to teach them, do not lick the floor in those places or wash your hands after you've been playing in the subway floor, if that ever happened, and especially to do it before you eat and after you use the washroom.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about hand washing. It's easy. I certainly get a little, not obsessive about it, but I wash my hands a lot. Where's the right line to draw for kids?
Well, with hand washing, the good is that it's a practice that has been studied really, really well for decades. So we know when it's effective and when it really doesn't make a difference. And it is. Before we make food and before we eat, after we use the restroom, if we have been in contact with anyone that is sick, if we ourselves are sick to try and prevent other people from getting sick, or if we, for whatever reason, have been in contact with animal waste or with anything that is decomposing. Beyond that, hand washing makes no difference in terms of disease prevention. We know now that we do not need to wash ourselves with antibacterial soap. It's no more effective, and in fact, the FDA just did something really good at banning some of the chemicals that are most common in antimicrobial products. They're really not good for you, and they're not really effective in preventing disease. They do have a place, for example, if you're camping and you do not have a good source of water. But other than that, plain old school soap and water is what you need during those times that I just mentioned.
Yeah, you mentioned antibacterial soap. How about those hand sanitizers? Purell is the brand a lot of people encounter, those alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Are those maybe overkill?
Completely. We do not need them. And again, they don't really work in preventing disease if you continuously use them. We should just aim for regular soap and water. I think anything beyond that is totally over-sanitizing ourselves. And you see them everywhere. Now I have kids in school, and you kind of see them hanging from every other backpack. The same thing with diaper bags. You see them everywhere. There's this idea that the more you clean yourself, the safer you are, when that's just not the case, according to science. So we don't need them, again, unless we're camping or if we're caring for someone that's sick or if we're in a hospital. But for our everyday living, we do not need them.
We've been talking a lot about what not to do. Let's talk about some more positive things. Let's talk about food. Are there foods that parents can keep in mind to promote healthy gut bacteria in particular?
Yes. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how good exposure your kids have with microbes. If you don't feed those microbes the right things, they're going to end up dying anyway. And that's one of the, I call it, crisis that we have in modern society. And it is the type of food that we feed our microbes. Microbes rely on our fiber intake to thrive in our gut. And we nowadays live in a pretty fiber-depleted world. So think about feeding your kids fibers in natural occurring forms, vegetables and fruits in every single meal, including snacks and breakfast, as well as substituting all the refined grains like rice and wheat with the whole variety. So using brown rice and using whole wheat. And if you substitute all your refined grains for the whole variety, you're already increasing the fiber intake by a ton. So you don't really need to be eating bran cereal all day to eat a good amount of fiber. You just need to eat it throughout the day in the natural occurring forms. So that's the best thing that you can do. And also supplementing with fermented foods, so yogurt, the ones that have live microbes in it, kefir, sauerkraut, pickled vegetables, all those are good.
We're talking about microbes and kids. Our guest is Marie Claire Arrieta. She says we've gone too far in our quest to sanitize the world that our children live in. She's the co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you handle cleanliness for your kids? And what were things like when you grew up? How much hand washing do you require for your kids? And how dirty do you let them get? Do you think maybe we've gone too far in keeping things clean? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with microbiologist Marie Claire Arrieta, and we're looking at her new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World.
And you could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you super zealous about hand washing and hygiene in your household? Do your kids have opportunities to get dirty? How are things different now compared to your own childhood? Call 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. Paul is on the line in White River. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Paul?
I wanted to say how wonderful this program is. In my life and my people, we have never stressed or focused on microbes or germs. We don't even have a word for them. And I think that it's very important to eat things that are that wouldn't be sanitized. And I think native peoples have always known this, and it wasn't until Europeans came here with the idea of cleanliness their science that they ruined the natural state of things. We bury salmon heads in the ground until they ferment, and we eat them. The salmon head, the cheeks and the forehead and all that, the salmon, and they're very good. And I just think it's another example of how bad science and bad technology from the Europeans have ruined a good life that we had.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. And Marie-Claire, do we see lessons from native cultures, maybe other cultures, where we could learn a thing or two?
Well, it's interesting. Well, to my knowledge, there hasn't been epidemiological studies done, particularly in Native American communities. But there have been plenty of studies done in areas of the world that still keep, you know, traditional form of living, and that they haven't seen the same level of industrialization like we do here in North America or in Europe. And what we see over there is interesting, because what we see is that in places in North Africa, for example, people are still suffering from dangerous infections because, you know, they're not following the same hygiene measures that we do. But interestingly, they do not have the same rates of immune and metabolic diseases that I was talking about before. So it seems that it's either one or the other, depending on where you look at the world. What we think is that ideally, in this part of the world, we can regain, or we are at least hopeful that we can regain that balance in which you can prevent dangerous disease. You do not need to get, you know, dangerous infections, while at the same time, you can harvest a diverse and a strong microbiome. So we don't think it's one or the other.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Jacqueline on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Jacqueline, hi.
Hi there. My question is, why has it taken so long for this to come to the forefront of the public eye? My daughter, 14 years ago, went to the University of Minnesota in microbiology, and she at that time told me to quit using antibacterial soaps and cleaners because it didn't do what they were supposed to be doing, and it was actually, you know, less beneficial to us to be using it. And so if it's that big of an issue, why is it taking so long for people to understand this?
Jacqueline, thanks. Marie-Claire, we've been figuring this out about antibacterials for a while now, she says.
Yeah. That's a great question, and it comes down to advances in technology. So it's until very recently that we really understand how critical microbes are to our physiology. They're involved in our behavior, for example. They're involved in how we burn fat, how we store it, and, of course, in the maturation of our immune system. I think before then we thought that they had a role, but we had no idea that it was so important. So I think it's that knowledge that was obtained through advances in technology. Microbiologists like myself, for the longest time, we were only able to study microbes by growing them. And there's only a very small proportion of microbes that grow in the lab. Of all the gut microbes that we have inside of us, about only 10% grow normally in the lab. The rest, we really had no idea, but now we can sequence them. And it's through sequencing that we've really understood how biodiverse is our microbial community in our gut, and that has changed things.
We're talking to Marie Claire Arrieta, author of the new book, co-author of the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Before we go back to our callers, Marie Claire, talking about how information gets out there, you talk a little bit in the book about media coverage of issues of microbes and things like that, and it doesn't always steer us in the right direction. What do you think is out there?
Well, there's a little bit of everything. I mean, there's some studies that are interpreted the right way. There's some, you know, good science journalists that wouldn't interpret a study as it is. But sometimes that doesn't happen. And at the end of the day, someone that may not have a background in science, it's reading all this information without knowing how to interpret a sometimes pretty complicated study. And that was one of the drivers for us to say, you know what, let's try and synthesize some of the best studies in this field and put it in lay terms for the general audience.
Back to our callers now. Ben is with us in Madison. Ben, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Hey, Marie, I wonder if you would mention briefly helminthic therapy and how that's being used in the West in a limited fashion, partly because the FDA and the medical establishment is conservative and not in a good way, but in a way that ultimately risks people's health. But what helminthic therapy is and how effective it can be for conditions like Crohn's, and also how that ties back into the hygiene hypothesis.
Marie Claire, I'm not sure what helminthic therapy is, first of all.
Yeah, so helminths are worms, and they belong to that big group of microbes that live inside of them. And just like with bacteria, there's some, you know, worms that will cause disease, and there's some that don't. Helminths, or these worms, they are known to really modulate or change the way our immune system behaves. The issue with helminthic therapy, as the caller was pointing out, there's some studies saying that it can be used to treat allergic diseases such as asthma or inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease. But the literature is a bit what we call noisy. There's some studies saying that it works. There's some studies saying that it does not work. Kind of like the same with probiotics. Probiotics, there's some studies that says that they work and some studies that says that they do not work. The FDA, and of course, they have to wait for the evidence to be sounding enough to recommend such a practice. But there's definitely lots of laboratory groups that are studying helminthic therapy. But I wouldn't go as far as to recommend it just because we do not have enough evidence to say, okay, this is definitely working. I think we might get there, but we need a little bit more time.
Ben, thanks for that call. Marie Claire, it sounds like in some ways we're standing on the frontier of something that could be really earth-shaking in the way we treat a lot of conditions. We're not there yet. Can you talk about some of the potential future for microbiome, I don't know, therapy, treatment?
Yeah, and you're spot on. We're at the verge of that. This is really groundbreaking science. Again, we didn't know much about this until about a decade ago. But there's a lot going on. So there's huge deals in the pharmaceutical industry, multi-million deals to study different therapies based on the microbiome. So they're studying what they call next-generation probiotics. So these are not the probiotics that we find now in natural health stores or in your yogurt. These are species of bacteria that normally we cannot grow in the lab, but we're finding ways of doing so, and we're trying to package them or formulate them to treat disease in kind of like the same way a drug treats disease, and study them and market them that way as well. So there's a huge, huge potential. Research-wise, there's a lot of research dollars that are being devoted to the microbiome field. It's a very exciting field to be in.
We'll leave it there for now. Marie Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Marie Claire Arrieta. She's a microbiologist and assistant professor at the University of Calgary. We've been talking about this new book she's co-author of. It's called Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Some of the lessons, more fiber, more fermented food. Don't worry so much about getting dirty. You can share some of your thoughts and find a little more out about the book over at the Central Time Facebook page.
The brains at NASA have just turned the zodiac on its head, or as they say, they just did the math and pointed out how the constellations are different now than they were when the first zodiac signs were doled out.
The upshot is you might be a different sign now, according to NASA's updated astronomical chart when it comes to the zodiac. For instance, I would be not a Leo, but a Cancer.
And I would be a Taurus instead of a Gemini. I looked at some of these qualities online. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think I'm very attached to being a Gemini at this point. Also, I'm not crazy about these negative Taurus qualities. Laziness, stubbornness, prejudice.
I don't really see those in you, I'm happy to say. I'll stick with my Leo identity for what it's worth. I'm not a big astrology watcher, to be sure. But yeah, I've got a little of that Leo identity that I'm not going to give up, no matter what NASA says.
Right. And if you were a Cancer, according to NASA, you would then be moody, pessimistic, and clingy. Again, I'm not really seeing it, although I guess you can get a little clingy during pledge.
Well, I am pessimistic about this new news from NASA. It's making me moody, and I'm going to cling to my Leo identity.
Oh, very nice.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.